My name is Mirka Naster, and I will moderate this program, an interfaith symposium on wise speech, communication as spiritual practice. Before I introduce the panel members, I would like to introduce myself and also say a few words about the topic of our program today. Some of you may remember me from a talk I gave here last year on speech ethics. And for those of you who weren't here, I'll just share a few things. As someone who was born and raised Jewish and who has also been engaged in Buddhist practice for about 25 years, I consider my life an ongoing interfaith dialogue. And I would imagine that many of you here feel the same way about your lives. My interest in organizing this program stems from doctoral research that I did in Asian and comparative studies. For my dissertation, I interviewed Dharma teachers and rabbis on how we transform our ordinary habits of talking into a spiritual practice of ethical speech. I realize that this term ethical speech is different in many traditions, but I use it as a cross-cultural term, as a cross-religious term. For example, as many of you know, in Theravada Buddhism, the Pali term is samavaca, which means right speech or wise speech or perfect speech. In Judaism, there's a Hebrew term, shmirat halashon, which means guarding the tongue, or preventing the opposite, which is lashon hara, or evil tongue, and so on in every tradition. I am interested particularly in how all of us can align the way we speak and listen with the highest aspirations of our faith traditions, because how we use our mouth and ears can lead to greater peace and harmony, or as we know, more chaos and violence, not only in our own lives, but in the world. And I'm presently working on a book on wise speech, as well as organizing similar programs to this one in other parts of the Bay Area, because I believe that developing personal speech ethics is an issue that goes beyond any doctrine or dogma. The members of this panel, as well as many people in the audience, probably disagree on certain doctrinal points. For example, how did we come to be? What is the divine? What happens after we die? But as the Dalai Lama and other religious leaders have commented, when it is a question of how to live a good life, a life that is conducive to peace, harmony, and well-being for all, there is a common ground where different faiths can easily meet. And that ground is ethical conduct, both physical and verbal. Our panel today is concerned with ethical verbal conduct, speaking and listening as a pathway to attaining the ultimate goals of our religions, as a pathway to peace not only for ourselves, but also for our families and our communities and the world at large. As Gandhi said, and I'm sure many of you have heard this quote before, be the change you wish to see in the world. If we want peace to prevail, first we need to make our own words and listening peaceful. For those of us who feel so frustrated and helpless in the face of present conflicts across the globe, respectful communication is something concrete that all of us can do. And it's something for which we need no ceremonial robes, no ritual objects, no designated building, no special holy day. Any day, every day, is a good day to speak in a way that reflects the highest qualities of our tradition. Any moment, every moment, presents us with a choice as to how we express ourselves to others and how we receive another's words. Before I introduce the members of the panel, I would like to set the tone for how we listen to people whose tradition is different from our own. I'm going to read from something called harmony among traditions. And this is from King Ashoka. Some of you may know who King Ashoka was, but for those of you who don't, he ruled an immense kingdom in what today is India and Pakistan. And he did this during the 3rd century BCE. He converted to Buddhism early in his reign after having conquered neighboring kingdoms and feeling great remorse over all of the destruction, all of the suffering that came from all of that warring. So he set himself the task of doing good works and civilizing his kingdom. And one of the things he did was to set up hospitals. Numerous inscriptions were put into stone, I guess we would call them stelae, and these pillars were all over his empire. And what I'm going to read to you today is from one of those pillars. And this, I'm reading it to you with the permission of Andrew Olensky, who translated this. King Ashoka honors all traditions and honors both ascetics and householders by giving gifts of various kinds. But the king himself does not value gifts or homage as much as growth in the essential teachings of all the traditions. Many factors contribute to this growth in the essential teachings, but the process is rooted in the restraint of speech. Insofar as one should not praise only one's own tradition and condemn the traditions of others without any ground, such criticisms should be on specific grounds only. Rather, the traditions of others should be honored on this ground and that. By doing so, one helps one's own tradition to grow and benefits the traditions of others as well. Otherwise, one hurts one's own tradition and injures the traditions of others. Harmony alone is commendable. Toward this end, all should be willing to listen to the doctrines professed by others. It is the wish of King Ashoka, that in all traditions there be great learning and benevolent teachings. And those who are content in their respective traditions should all be told that the king does not value gifts or homage as much as that all traditions flourish and that there be growth in their essential teachings. I made up some copies of this if anyone wants at the end. I don't think there'll be enough, but if you would like one, you can always email me. The significance of King Ashoka's words really struck me during this past month because I've just come back from Barcelona, where I attended the Parliament of the World's Religions. And one of our panel members was with me on the program I put on there. What deeply impressed me about this experience was that 7,000 people came from 75 countries representing the most enormous range of spiritual traditions. And they all came together in an atmosphere of mutual respect. It was a living example to me of what's possible when people actually apply what their tradition teaches about interpersonal interaction. I left Barcelona feeling so heartened about what these many groups are doing on an interfaith level around the world. And I came home feeling encouraged that we can work together when we consider not only prayer and meditation as spiritual activity, but we also make our communication a spiritual practice. In organizing the panel for today's program, I tried to be as inclusive as possible, both in terms of religious variety as well as gender. Obviously, it is impossible to have every tradition represented in a 2-hour program. And sometimes the balance gets thrown off because things come up in people's lives. So our Islamic Sufi representative called me yesterday. Her mother-in-law just died and she had to leave California. So we won't have her with us today, I'm sorry to say. And if you notice that some groups are not represented, you can certainly make suggestions to me for another program. Sometimes it was just too difficult to get people to respond. So I'm enormously grateful to the panel today because everybody said yes, and with real sincerity. So thank you for coming. All of you who are part of the Sangha know Gil Fronsdale, but we have other visitors here today, so I'm going to introduce him as well. Gil Fronsdale has a PhD in Buddhist Studies from Stanford University. He was trained by Jack Kornfield in the Insight Meditation lineage of Theravada Buddhism from Southeast Asia. He's part of the Vipassana Teachers Collective at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Marin County. He also was ordained a Soto Zen priest at the San Francisco Zen Center in 1982, and in 1995 he received Dharma transmission from Mel Weitzman, who is the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center. Since 1990, he's been the primary teacher for the Insight Meditation Center. He has published both popular and academic writings on Buddhism. Rabbi Sheldon Lewis, third person in, has been the spiritual leader of Congregation Kol Emet, an egalitarian conservative synagogue in Palo Alto, for more than 30 years. He was educated at the University of Chicago, the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and several yeshivot in Israel. He has had an abiding concern for reconciliation efforts in the Middle East as a member of Rabbis for Human Rights and as a board member of the Compassionate Listening Project. And I'd like to add that he was also generous enough to be one of the people I interviewed for my dissertation on speech. Amy Purchase Reed became a member of the Baha'i Faith in 1983 in Green Lake, Wisconsin, after an intensive spiritual search. She's a graduate of Stanford University Law School, and she's been in private practice since 1982. Together with her husband, Anthony Reed, who is also an attorney, she devotes volunteer time to mentoring and empowering youth. Eric Sableman began attending Quaker meetings in Pasadena in 1969 and continued in 1971 with the Palo Alto Friends meeting, where he has served in various capacities. Currently, he is Quaker representative to Stanford Associated Ministries. Dr. Sableman is a biomedical engineer at the Rehabilitation Research and Development Center of the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System, and he's also on the consulting faculty of Stanford University Medical School and Santa Clara University Department of Mechanical Engineering. Jasjit Kaur is co-founder and vice president of the International Institute of Gurmat Studies, which holds spiritual camps teaching the values of love, equality, and humility according to the Sikh gurus around to young people all over the world. She has presented papers on a wide variety of subjects related to spirituality and holistic living in North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia, and she's also taught at Delhi University. In recent years, she has been a human resources consultant in staffing and management training in Silicon Valley. And Jessie, as I know her, was part of my panel at the Parliament. And I thank her for coming again, second time. Reverend John Beverly Butcher is a priest of the Episcopal Diocese of California, an associate fellow of the Jesus Seminar, and a fellow of the Canadian College of Chinese Studies. His Master of Divinity is from the Berkeley Divinity School at Yale. He came to California in 1969, serving as pastor of Holy Trinity in Menlo Park, and then as rector of St. Peter's in San Francisco. Prior to that, he served in churches in Arizona and was chaplain of Arizona State Prison. Reverend Butcher has taught at Stanford and has worked extensively with the Guild for Psychological Studies. He is currently doing research into the experience and practices of the early church and is the author of several books. Professor Yi Wu received his MA and PhD from the University of Chinese Culture in Taipei. He was head of the philosophy department at Taiwan University for 7 years before coming to the United States. In Taiwan, he was declared a national treasure as a distinguished scholar of ancient culture and as a sage. He has been teaching at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco since 1980. As a former student of Dr. Wu, I can attest to this. His approach to teaching and to his life in general is very much in alignment with the principles of the Chinese philosophies he teaches. He is the author of more than 17 books in Chinese and English. So thank you to all panel members. What I'm going to do is ask the panel members a series of questions, and rather than go in any kind of particular order, I'd like people to just jump in when you're ready to respond. So we don't have to go in one direction or another, but as you feel moved to respond, and I believe we have a mic that we can pass along to whoever wants to speak. Since not everyone here is familiar with the details of each spiritual tradition that you all represent, I'd like to start by asking you, what is the ultimate goal of your religion? What are you moving toward as you practice your faith? And I'm not looking for a... a long paper or a long speech or anything, just something simple so that people would understand as you're practicing Judaism or Sikhism or a Quakerism, what is the absolute goal that you're moving toward? Whoever would like to start, please go ahead. And don't be shy. Please don't be shy.
Since my name starts with Amy, I thought I could just take the lead. First of all, I'm just speak as an individual working to practice the Baha'i teachings. And I would say that Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith, brought about the religion in an effort to unify the entire planet. So we work on personal transformation, which gets to the topic today. Mm-hmm. And then we work on a collective sort of societal basis in order to build unity within our social circles. And then we think about universal unification, all inclusiveness of all people, all backgrounds.
Thank you.
Marika, you had the core belief of your tradition. You're going to get to that?
If you like, you can speak about that.
Oh, well, the two relate.
What?
I say the two questions you had, they relate to each other.
Oh, that's fine.
So I'll start with the second one,
okay,
which you just asked about. Our goal,
yes.
I think it's summarized in the high priestly prayer of Jesus, that they all might be one. Mm-hmm. Not that different from Baha'i. And the core center of our tradition is, I tried to think, it's a good question you'd posed, can I put it in one word? And I can. The word is incarnation. Enfleshment. Or embodiment. So we're convinced that one in particular discovered that, Jesus, in his baptism in the Jordan River, was his enlightenment, just like Buddha had his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. So Jesus had his in the Jordan River, and he came into oneness and an awareness as one who shows us the way toward ours.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Sikh tradition. Our scripture is called the Sri Guru Granth Sahib. It enshrines the teachings of the Sikh gurus, six of them, plus Hindu saints and Muslims and Sufis. It's a universalist, pluralistic scripture. And to sum up its teachings in one line, it says that we are children of one God, we are all equal, men and women, and we are here to realize our own divinity. The Sikh gurus in their prayers asked every Sikh to pray for the upliftment and prosperity of every human being. So every day when we pray, we end our prayer with Nanak Naam Charti Kala Tere Bhane Sarbat Kapala. In the name of Nanak, who is the founder of the Sikh faith, I pray to God that your name and your energy and your spirit abide in everyone, and may every child of yours prosper. In the same spirit, Guru Nanak said, O God, whatever door your devotees seek you from, bless them. The purpose of life, according to the Sikh tradition, is to realize our own divinity. I'll quote again from the scripture. It says, Bhai parapat manuk de huriya, gobind milan ki etari bariya. They were supposed to have 8,400,000 species. And the precious human birth is attained after going through the cycle of life and death of 8,400,000 species. This human birth is very precious, and it is given to you so you may have this opportunity to realize your own divinity. That's the purpose of life.
It's always a good exercise to try to put your faith into the smallest number of words, especially a faith like Quakerism, which is centered on silence. Smallest number of words, as the goal of our faith is to know the light within. And in the mid-1600s, when the Quaker faith was growing out of a chaotic period in England, there were numerous groups all seeking and trying to escape the mixture of war and politics and religion, all of which were coming together then. And they found a way to do that by moving out from the Christian tradition and letting go of a lot of what they had felt that the Christian tradition had accumulated. So Quakers, from that time on, have not had professional clergy, nor sacraments, outwardly at least, nor a creed to follow. And since that time, things have you know, there have been schisms, and there have been disputes, and there have been all the human things. But to seek the light within, and to do it as an individual within a community, is really the core of what we're trying to do. I'll mention one more thing, because it's a lot of this. You ask a Quaker, and you'll find different words for this every single time, even the same Quaker speaking. Being trained as an engineer, I use tools. And in trying to discover the light within, or the seed, or the Christ within, or the kingdom within, whatever you want to call it, you have no tool except yourself. There is no other way that we know.
I think the problem for Jews is the opposite problem. We have too many words. But it's a great exercise, and I would say that the purpose of Judaism, Jewish tradition, is to nurture and to shape a holy person, and then by extension a holy community, and ultimately for holiness to encircle the globe. And by holiness, I mean a constant awareness of God's presence in every time and in every place. And I also mean something which, you know, a practice which embraces every part of being human, thought and speech, which I know is the focus today, and action. And all of that, not only for personal transformation, but to do tikkun olam, to at least, with whatever energies one can marshal, to reach out into the world and to leave it at least a little bit more healed and perfect.
Oh, good friends. First, I need put my position of Confucius, but I find all these religions. But Confucius, to Chinese people, I think is philosophy. Mm-hmm. So come here. Most people think Confucius is a religion. So the supreme, the ultimate goal of Chinese philosophy, Confucius, Taoism, or Chinese Zen school, I think is harmony.
Harmony.
So religion and philosophy in harmony. Heaven, people in harmony. Mm-hmm. Heaven, earth in harmony. Mm-hmm. This is Yi Jing, the Book of Change, emphasizes. Also, Confucius emphasized harmony is politics. The ruler, minister in harmony. The family, husband, wife in harmony. Mm-hmm. Brother, sister in harmony. People and everything in harmony. So harmony is ultimate goal. But I want to emphasize, not just ultimate goal, also a small goal, mm-hmm. daily life goal is harmony.
So to speak somewhat for the Buddhist tradition, the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, the there is understood to be a potential or a seed in each individual that some Buddhists would call the divine within us, but some potential that is probably best explained as for liberation, for a heart which is not shackled or tight or constricted in any way, but rather is quite expansive, so expansive that heart includes everything within it. Nothing's excluded, nothing's left out. And so the fulfillment of that potential is when all things are found within it, within that large heart, big mind. And an expression of this potential, this seed or this good heart within us, is that of kind of a empathy and compassionate care for the suffering of others and for encouraging the development of this potential in all beings so that everyone together can live with an all-encompassing mind and heart that is free and loving.
Thank you. This next question is, I'll describe it in two parts. I would like to get an understanding of what ethical speech is according to your philosophy or faith or religion. And you can use whatever term is appropriate if ethical speech is not the right word. And in describing what ethical speech is in your tradition, could you share with us a piece of text or scripture that illustrates what wise or ethical speech is?
Okay, talk about maybe Chinese philosophy include these three religion or philosophies. First, so Confucius emphasized speech. So you give people and call me is a speech. And the lesson, the title, speech and the lesson. I find my book, this 45 years ago. 45. This is one essay I wrote. The title is speech and listening.
And listening.
First paragraph, I emphasize. We all think the speech is two person, speech, you listen. Mm-hmm. The actual most important is you speech, you listen. Mm-hmm. They're very close. This is a very good lesson. This first paragraph. The conclusion I say, if you speech, you listen, you know that's not good. Don't speech. Uh-huh. So you already listen, you know. Maybe you speak, you cheat other people don't know, but you already listen. So Confucius emphasized speech, language. Confucius teaching, one is language very important, speech. From students, from beginning, teaches them speech. Talk of speech, same as Buddhism, some slander, some is gossipy, same. Confucius criticize what speech, skillful speech not good, sweet talking speech not good. The speech not trust not good. The speech not in accord with righteousness not good. This most people, most religion knows. But one disciple said, Confucius, we never talk about four things. Four. One is strange thing. Second is violence. The third is chaotic, disorder. The last one, Confucius, we never talk about it. Gods. Spirituals. Maybe superstitious meaning. So this confusion is not a good speech. But talk a positive meaning, speech should follow four. Sincerity, humility, humbleness, humility, harmony, and proper way. These four is the foundation of a speech. Thank you.
I think in Jewish sources there's a very acute awareness of the opposite potential of speech to be very, very good or to be very, very bad, to lift up another or to do damage that one rabbinic saying has it, to slander another as if to shed one's blood. There's one particular verse that I love from the book of Proverbs that says, in the original, it says, Chaim v'mavet b'yad halashon, that life and death come through the agency of speech. And I wanted to share with you one, Mirka had asked for one story or source, and so I picked out one that's been a favorite of mine for a long time. It actually comes from the literature of Midrash, largely of imaginative commentary on scriptures. And this comes from Leviticus Rabbah. And this story actually comes from the second century about one Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, a great rabbi in that period, who had a servant by the name of Tavi, who was wiser than he. And wiser than his master, and it comes out in many different stories about him. And this is one favorite story. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said to Tabai, his servant, "Go and buy me good food in the market." He went and bought him tongue. He said to him, "Go and buy me bad food in the market." I don't know why one would want to do that, but "Go and buy me bad food in the market." He went and bought him tongue. Said he to him, when Shimon ben Gamliel said to his servant, "What is this? When I told you to get good food, you bought me tongue. And when I told you to get bad food, you bought me tongue." He replied, "Good comes from it and bad comes from it. When the tongue is good, there is nothing better. And when it is bad, there is nothing worse." Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel made a feast for his disciples and placed before them tender tongues, leaving the tender tongues and hard tongues. They began selecting the tender ones, leaving the hard ones alone. Said he to them, "Note what you are doing. As you select the tender and leave the hard, so let your tongues be tender to one another."
I at least had to offer. I'm eager to go first. A couple of points. When you ask, when I was reflecting on speech, I had to consider process and how over the years I hope that my speech as a practicing Baha'i has improved. And so I had to reflect on the process for that improvement, which engages prayer, which in the Baha'i teachings we have the authentic prayers from the founder of the faith. So we have the words of Baha'u'llah to recite as prayer and meditate on. And then we, similar to the practices here at this center, we engage meditation. We develop our practice in meditation. We use reflection. And I think through all of those things, it enables a Baha'i to improve their speech and translate that speech into action. Because in the Baha'i teachings, speech, although very important, the actions are really the most important. And similar to the comment about few words in the Baha'i teachings, a fewness of words is much better than as manifesting many results. So the actions are key in the Baha'i teachings. The other aspect I wanted to mention, so that's kind of from a personal transformation perspective and utilizing the writings to become a better person or bringing out the God or divinity in each of us. The other aspect about the Baha'i faith that I find very interesting and which was very attractive to me is the social development and bringing about this in our social circles and in the world at large. And there's a tool that Baha'is rely on, and I'd like to read a little bit about that tool, and it's called consultation. And though I'm a practicing attorney and we consult with clients, the Baha'i consultation is quite different. And I think it bears a little bit of reading to get very clear on what that is, because it's so different than what I encounter with an attorney-client consultation type of thing. So I would like to read a little bit of that if I can put my hands on it quick enough. Well, I'm at a loss for my particular site. At any rate, I can ad lib because I've been working on this for years. Essentially, there are various instances when one can engage the process of consultation. I might be embarking on an area in my life where I'm troubled or I'm seeking some assistance from a friend. In that instance, I will engage the process of consultation. If I'm working with a group and we're talking about bringing a project into being, I would engage the process of consultation with that group. And essentially, the importance of it from evolving a global society that's functioning and healthy is this, that we bring forth our ideas about the situation, circumstance, or condition, and bring those ideas forward in a quote-unquote detached manner. So I may have an idea, I may bring it out in a family situation or a social situation, and I detach from that idea, meaning that if my counterpart or colleague expresses an idea and builds on that idea or is very different from that idea, we all put them on the table and allow the process to evolve in a manner that we're not argumentative, we're not aggressive with each other, but we're very frank and we're very honest, and all in that process we're very loving. And of course, over time, I've had to change because I have been in the litigation field. I've been a practicing attorney. So when I say the Baha'i teachings have allowed me to grow, essentially it has allowed me to move from that space of this is my owning an idea and taking it and leaving it on the table. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, the Baha'i consultation, when we talk about speech and ethics, consultation allows us to grow in a collective manner, whereby we have also a confidence in each other's spirituality, getting again to recognizing that divinity in each other. So when I engage with others, I honor their spirituality, I value their contribution, and I look for ways and how to reach the best solution. So I consciously detach from my own idea, and I am looking, and I rely on my partner, colleague, associate, or whomever, that they are also looking to reach that same high level of result and in sort of solution, if you will, that's appropriate for that time, because we also believe that we're evolving, times change, etc., and we may have to review that. And at the same time, as a group, we're detached from what the decision that we've arrived at earlier, because it may not be appropriate for that next stage. So in that sense, I find it extremely special and unique in the Baha'i teachings, this art of consultation.
And if Quakers were to talk about consultation, they would call it clearness, because that's our version of what's probably the same basic process. I mean, we humans have only a limited repertoire of ways of dealing with words and the differences between words. What I was going to speak to you about is the form of worship that Quakers use, which is a meeting in silence, with the possibility of any individual there speaking out of that silence, being inspired, hearing the word of God, if you will, and presenting that to the rest of the community that's gathered there. And then that particular form gets translated into a meeting for worship on the occasion of business. I'm sure those who have sat through a Quaker business meeting who are here might very well roll their eyes, because this is much more difficult to practice than it is to say how it's supposed to work. To start with, we all must agree in an understanding that we are gathered to do the same basic thing, to try to come to an understanding. In one respect, we'd call it God's will. In another respect, you might say, what really is the right life that we should be leading at this moment on this particular issue? I did make some handouts for you. But I didn't make near enough, and we'll try to see that you get some if you didn't. These are a mixture of things on Quaker worship and a two-page conversion of the meeting for business format into a process for other organizations to use. And in this case, it was for the board of Earthlight magazine that I sit on, and several of the other Quakers who were on that board translated the format for a meeting for business into something that you could use in a non-religious organization. To start with, you are doing silence first, and everything comes out of that. And when you have an issue that needs to be spoken on in a meeting for business, people will stand and speak to that, allowing silence in between each voice. And the clerk of the meeting is not generally speaking to that, but is charged with recognizing when all the words that need to be spoken are spoken, and that there's a sense of unity among everyone who's there. And being human, there's always the possibility that we will never reach unity on a decision that needs to be made. Quite often, it's laid over for more seasoning. I mean, in all of these practices, we start, you know, for 350 years we've been doing this, so there are words that are left over from the King James version of this that we carry on. So things may be laid over, or one individual may have a stop or a bar. They may actually feel themselves sufficiently at odds with what seems to be the gathering consensus, and the consensus word consensus is sometimes used to describe this, and people claim they use Quaker forms of consensus. But sense of the meeting is a different kind of thing, and it's to look at levels below what we might see on the surface, because we have a common goal, and recognizing how we get to it is what the meeting for business is trying to do. So each person will speak once to the issue, if necessary more than that. The clerk will see that all the words that have been spoken need to be spoken and see whether or not there is consensus. If a person needs to object to that, they will say that they can only agree if they are
recorded as standing aside and allowing the rest of the group to move on. Or they may say that they have a bar and everything stops. No action is taken. Because we have to recognize that the perception of truth does not reside in uniformly among us, but someone may have a sudden sudden opening that allows them to see something the rest of us don't see. And so choosing the word or the that opens for everyone what that one person has seen is a part of this process, and it's most difficult to do. Sometimes on great issues, on opposing war, it's easy to do because our common understanding of what we intend to do is there and open to us all, and the clerk moves on quickly to the next item of business. On buying a new rug for the meeting house, obviously, God has no preference, and it devolves into our own personal preferences. And making the decision can be much more difficult. I will leave you with one thing that I wrote, or at least the headings from something I wrote on Quaker worship. How you do it? In 5 steps. First to pray, then to attend, which means to be empty and open to what comes to you. Third is to accept that, because often we reject what comes. Fourth is to offer it, because it often isn't just for you, it's for the whole community. And once offered, you've done your part. Be still and be no longer an individual striving, but part of the whole and the harmony and all.
I faced a real challenge a year and a half or so ago. A close member of the family started becoming very hostile to me. This is someone that professed to care for me a lot, but she wanted to control me, control my affection, control the time I spent with other people. And when she felt that she couldn't do that, she became verbally very abusive, very nasty, started yelling, started protesting. And I'm not at all a confrontational person. I tend to walk away. I tend to want to diffuse situations. I was totally perplexed. I didn't know how to respond to it. From the time when I was a child, my orientation was that the Sikh scripture, the Sri Guru Granth Sahib, is akin to a living guru for me, and I have to go there for guidance. It was very ironic, because as an HR consultant, part of what I teach is communication, and here I was up against a difficult person, and I didn't know how to communicate. So I decided to delve into the guru, and was amazed at the guidance I got. It's a 1,430-page scripture, and I started, my husband has digitized it, so it was available to me on a CD researcher with a search engine. So it was easy. So I could research into it. And it was amazing. One of the first things I learned was the injunction that you are in this world, honey, and you have to listen, and you have to speak. Jab tak Duniya Rahi Hai Nanak. I'm going to quote from Gurbani because I think the words have their own effect. Kuch suniye, kuch kahiye. You have to say something. You have to listen to something. So don't walk away. You have to say something. Mm-hmm. But how you say it is the key. Mit bol raji har sajjan swami mora. The first injunction, sweetness. The entire cosmic energy is sweet. God is sweet. Nature is sweet. It is benevolent. It doesn't take back what it gives. It bestows in abundance. There is sweetness and grace. So everything that you have to say has to be sweet. Always sweet. Tried and tested and true. Sweetness begets sweetness. But in real life it doesn't. You know, I continue to be sweet, but I didn't get sweetness back. I got yelled back. So the next injunction was, when you encounter such a person, you know, reflect. Sagal bolan me mahi bichar. Think about what they're saying. And then decide not to engage. Walk away. You know, be firm. Say that you will not put up with this nonsense. And then walk away. Murke naal na lujiye. Don't engage with a foolish person. Par akkar eho puchiye. After you have read and understood, that is the essence. Don't engage with a foolish person. Don't make them see sense. Because they come from a space of ego. And when you come totally from your own egoistic or egotistical, the T, you know, as an English literature teacher, I always wondered what the difference was between egoistic and egotistic. And one of my literature teachers told me that when somebody talks too much out of the ego center, it's tistic, the T, egotistic. So they're always into self-praise and self-extolling. And so when you say that, then you walk away. Jithe bolan hariye, othe chup changi. When you know that you're going to lose and you butt heads, you're going to get hurt. There, silence is the best. And do walk away. Don't feel bad. Don't think that this is a sign of losing. It's a sign of wisdom to be able to not engage and to be able to walk away. Then to seek the company of those that speak sweetly and that exude humility and sweetness. Slowly try to change your circle of friends, your circle of associates. Sadh Sangat, the company of saints, places like this, people like this, where people want to listen, where they want to learn, where they want to engage from the heart. And don't get taken in by sweetness that is only on the surface. The Guru says, yes, there are people who are very sweet, but the hunter kneels down and is very sweet. Aparadhi duna nive, and he shoots the deer. So beware of people that are hypocrites, that are sweet-tongued, but spit out venom. When you see somebody talking about somebody else in a vicious, vitriolic manner, know that they will do the same about you. Don't confide in them. Don't associate with them. Tell them that you don't want to listen to this stuff because words have a power of creating and demolishing. And words can purify and uplift. Sunte punit, kehte pavit. Those who listen to goodness will be uplifted. Those who utter goodness will be uplifted. But those who listen to slander will be dragged down into the mire of ugliness. And those who partake in it will equally be affected by it. So, walk away. Don't engage in slander or backbiting. It's negative energy. And then too, there is so much within you. The whole macrocosm is within you. The word that resounds outside, that created the whole universe, is within you. So listen. And when you listen with your eyes closed and centered within yourself, and you listen for a long time, the practice of listening actually enables the word or the shabad, the celestial word. It is called the unstruck melody. And you begin to hear it not with your ears, but with what is known as the dasamdwar, the top of the skull, which is the center of the soul, and you actually hear the unstruck word. And we all have that power, that capability of hearing it. It's a beautiful sound. It's a mix between bells and the tabla, the drums. And you hear it, and the whole world resounds with it. And when you hear that word, it has the ability to calm you. And then whatever comes out is sweetness. And that is the essence. Mit Bolaraji, Harsajjan Swami Mora. Until that becomes intuitive, reflect, pause. Sagal Bulan Me Mai Bichar. Just like my friend here said, listen to your own talk. Listen to your thoughts. The person who was very hostile to me said that she was very honest. And she said what came in her heart. You know, that's not proper. Is truth hurtful? Is it necessary? Is it kind? If it is none of the above, then show restraint and keep that truth silent. Don't let it hurt. And let your words be kind no matter what. And if you find that that kindness is being challenged, then in that moment, walk away. Thank you.
I like being next to a Sikh. Our gospel today was seek and you will find. The heart of our tradition in the Episcopal Church is Jesus and the gospel. And until recently, we only had four gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But more have been discovered. We are recovering much of our lost early tradition. As a matter of fact, the earliest of our tradition. Jesus spoke. He didn't write anything down. Terrible oversight on his part. People listened to him, told others, and so on. So it was not until the year 50 that people... He died about the year 30. And it wasn't until about the year 50 that collections of sayings were put together. The oldest of those is the Gospel of Thomas, and we now finally have it. And in there are some gems which relate to the question that you have given to us. Jesus says, love your friends like your own soul. Protect them like the pupil of your eye. When you're close to someone, you look into the person's eye. What do you see? But a reflection of yourself. So communication has to do with how we look at each other. And one of the recurring phrases in the teachings of Jesus is, you got two good eyes, take a look. You got two good ears, listen up. And those phrases occur over and over again in all the Gospels. So in communication, Jesus says, and this one is also found in the Gospels of Luke and Matthew, which we had, but I said it earlier in Thomas, Jesus says, you see the sliver in your friend's eye, but you don't see the timber in your own. Jesus doesn't mind exaggerating a little bit. I mean, if you got a timber in your own eye, you're blind, right? Okay. So when you take the timber out of your own eye, then you'll see well enough to remove the sliver from your friend's eye. You see, Jesus was a Jungian. In Jungian thought, in psychology today, we have a process known as projection. We project onto others what is within ourselves. And Jesus didn't use the word projection, but he certainly understood the process as he illustrates in this very short teaching. So how this works is, if you would in a moment just think of someone you cannot stand. Someone who drives you up the damn wall. And then I try to identify what it is that's so irritating about that person. And then turn it around and ask, is there any of that in me? And don't be too quick to dismiss it. And we learn something about ourselves. We usually condemn in others what we're not looking at or not aware of in ourselves.
But projections work two ways. Think now of someone that you think is wonderful, someone you admire and respect, a hero in your life, or someone you've fallen in love with. And when you have that person, then think about, what are the qualities of this person you so admire? And when you have that, then, is that in you? And don't be too quick to dismiss it. Because often the qualities which we so admire in others are projections of what's in ourselves and might be less developed. So we need to be in touch with our projections, as Jesus suggests to us. But we do this as individuals. We also do this as nations. And that's where we get into a lot of trouble on one example. We've been looking at another country, pointing the finger at Iraq and saying, oh, they've got weapons of mass destruction. That's terrible. We've yet to find them. Who has more weapons of mass destruction than any other country on the planet? It is the United States of America. Who's spending all enormous amounts of money designing and stockpiling weapons of mass destruction? Where are the brains for that? Right here. Over in Livermore, we're working on getting new ways to spread anthrax by aerosol. New ways to spread plague by aerosol. So before we condemn other countries, and I have a map which shows you where all our weapons of mass destruction are being stored, developed, and so on. So we need to take back our projections and clean up our own act. And this is where the gospel of Jesus speaks to the individual life and our corporate life, our shared life, the way our country acts and motivates us to be Quakers. Who are people for peace.
Somehow, by listening to all this, I'm reminded of a saying that goes something like, we have two ears and one mouth, so we can listen twice as much as we speak. Ethical speech or wise speech is considered central to the Buddhist tradition, and there are two primary reasons why it's central. One is could be seen as more ethical in the sense that we want to have speech which doesn't cause harm to others, and rather than cause harm, one that maybe is conducive towards the benefit of self and others. And the second reason why speech is central to the tradition is that why speech is seen as a very important stepping stone or support for the spiritual path itself, for the cultivation of a spiritual life, whether it's for oneself personally or for a society that is more liberated and kind and spiritual. Speech becomes a very important part of that. I was pleased to hear I think it was the Jewish quote about life and death, because there is in Buddhism a saying that says words can kill and words can bring to life. And so are we careful enough with our speech to know what we're killing, or what we're bringing to life, what we're supporting, what we're nourishing? We here at IMC are part of the kind of the meditative traditions of Buddhism. And in those traditions, there's a saying that when you meditate, watch your mind. When you're out and about in society, watch your speech. And I think it's a very profound saying, because speech is a very effective window into understanding ourselves And so a lot of what Buddhists do around speech is look at the intention that is represented in the speech acts that we say. So if I'm going to say something, do I say it because the person needs to have that information, because it's helpful or helpful for me or for them? Or do I say it because I want to appear smart? Or do I want to try to manipulate the situation so I can get something out of it? And since speech has to do with interpersonal relationships, paying attention to our intention, our motivation around speaking, we learn a lot about our relationships with people around us. And as we use that as a window to understand ourselves, it also then is a window to try to create a healthy community and healthy society around us. So in our tradition, we have a lot of focus on mindfulness, careful attention to our motivations. And there are four kind of guidelines around right speech or the motivations around speech that are stated in the tradition both in the negative terms of what to avoid and also the positive formulation of what to try to cultivate and develop. In the negative formulation, they are to avoid falsehood, to avoid lying, to avoid harsh speech, speech which causes people harm, intends to cause people harm, and avoid slanderous speech or gossip that's understood to be speech which causes division, that causes different people to be alienated from each other, be hostile to each other in some way. And then, and Mark, what's the fourth one?
Idle chatter.
Idle chatter.
Some papalapa.
You didn't bring your representative to help you. And then to avoid idle chatter, kind of chatter that is maybe draining of our energies and it's not conducive to anything in particular. The positive formulation of this is to speak the truth. And so to look in at our speech and say, is what I'm going to say, is it true? And if it's not true, then avoid it at all costs for Buddhists. And the second is, is it for the benefit? Is it benefiting others? Is it kind? Is it an expression of love? And if it's not, then be very careful about it. You don't necessarily have to avoid it if it's not kind, but you should be very careful. And if it's you can't do it in healthy ways, see if you can find the kindness within yourself, the love within you, so you can come from that when you speak. And then, is it beneficial? Or to go in order, the other order. And the third one would be, is it conducive for harmony? Does it create greater harmony among everyone, among you and the person you're talking to, or among the wider community that you're part of? And if it doesn't create greater harmony, then maybe avoid that speech. But if it tends to create concord, then use it. Or try to find the way that you can say concord, you bring concord and harmony. And the challenge, I think, in wise speech in Buddhism is to be creative in our speech, to use these guidelines and then see, well, how can I say what I need to say here? Even if I'm admonishing someone, how can I say it in such a way that it leads to greater harmony among everyone rather than alienation? And then the fourth positive formulation is that of is it beneficial? So that goes, with the idle speech. Is it beneficial speech? Does it have some benefit for others or for oneself? And if it doesn't have any benefit for anybody at all, then perhaps remaining silence is beneficial. There's a lot of benefits to be found in silence, as has been talked about a little bit. And to mention one is that silence, rather than being kind of an absence or a dryness, silence is a very creative area in which kind of the depths of our heart, the depths of our community, has a chance to bubble up and surface and show itself. And if we're always talking, then we almost kind of put a cover over some of the depths of who we are. And so that give ourselves enough time to be in silence is very important. And I'll end with one quote from the Buddha where he said, better than a thousand words. Yeah, you can maybe know.
Better than
speaking a thousand. Yeah.
Better than 1,000 useless words is one word of peace.
Yeah, better than 1,000. Am I cheating? Better than 1,000 useless words is one word that brings peace. It doesn't matter who says it. Better than 1,000 useless words is one word that brings peace.
Although I have other questions, I'd like to ask if any of you wants to ask anybody else on the panel a question that either relates to what was already spoken or that you want to investigate more. Because I heard similarities, and I also know background things that kept resonating for me. So I'm wondering if anyone, if you want to talk with each other at all.
I'd just like to mention.
Eric said everything went fine until they had a meeting and tried to determine about the rug for the meeting house. Now, in the Episcopal Church in St. Peter's, San Francisco, a group of artists offered to paint the sanctuary a beautiful cobalt blue, which would replace a horrible hospital green. And they would donate the time and the materials, and so would we accept this offer. And our vestry was tied, you know, 6-4 and 6 against. I'm the rector, I can break the tie. But we let it season and stayed with it until finally we graciously accepted their offer. So, you know, with all these wonderful things we're saying, it really comes down to such presumably insignificant things as a rug for the meeting house or the color we're going to paint the sanctuary.
Avoiding idle chatter is something that we haven't paid close enough attention to, and so I'm glad you brought it up. I have my radio set to wake me up to this classical music station, which now has online, you know, on-air personalities, people who talk. And I wake up every morning thinking, what do you have to say that Bach didn't say better?
Just one thought, Eric. It seemed that almost all of us, not everyone, but we're drawn immediately into approaches to conflict resolution, whether it's about rug or a color. And boy, I would love to, maybe it's another session, but simply to raise that, I mean, how much we could learn from one another with this millennial experience about conflict resolution, even in a community of people who share the same faith and mostly share the same, but there disputes there will be, mm-hmm. and how we learn to compassionately both be forthright, learn not to engage or to engage or to move beyond that is something that it's so important in Jewish tradition. I can see it's so important in all of our traditions. It would be wonderful to learn from each mm-hmm. other more deeply, specifically on that.
Almost 20 years ago, I participated in a small meeting, same as this in Rusbergery. This time, we invite nine religions, discuss how to communication together. First 2 years, I was speaker of Taoism. Mm-hmm. Then the third year, they find no confusion. They ask me to speak of Confucius. Then lots of people say, they find, next 2 years you speak Taoism, today you change it to Confucius. Every surprise, look at religion change. So, In Chinese tradition, okay, I teach Confucius, I teach Taoism, I teach Buddhism, no problem, in harmony. No, I face all different religions, other countries, other traditions. So how to harmony? This 5 years ago, a colloquium of CIS, the old professor and student together, we talk about all religions. So we say a wisdom should understand united all religion into one. But the problem is very difficult, you know, to understand another religion. If I study Taoism and Confucianism, it's difficult. So many materials, difficult. So this time I emphasize what I mean wisdom. Wisdom not mean know all religion, all tradition, impossible. Wisdom is open yourself. I just open, accept your idea. So open, important. But open still Western term. In tradition, Confucianism, they do not use open. Mm-hmm. I think one word is very important. Once a Confucian disciple, Zigong, asked Confucius, please give me one word I can hold life practice. But Zigong, this disciple, is a businessman, economic. One word, I don't want so many Confucian teachings. Talk of Confucian virtue, I say more than 10. But Confucius just say one word, he said, empathy. I translate empathy. But this empathy, Su, translated to English, different meaning. Sometimes use compassion, sometimes use forgiving. But I still choose empathy. Because compassion is like some people suffering. I compassion, save them. Forgiving is like you are wrong, I forgive you. So different level. But the empathy, treat other people equal to you. I just put myself in other people's position to thinking myself. So empathy can break through all system, people to people. So I think people to people difficult to break through. So empathy, mm-hmm. No way, ultimate goal. Empathy is not like a morality. No, in modern society, I think most people against morality. Oh. They think morality is outside, force you to do something. Mm-hmm. In CIS, I teach, before I use morality, most psychology students, morality. Then I change inner virtue. And they have But the answer, Su, put everybody equal, thinking myself first. So what means Su, emphasis, in Confucius' definition is what I don't other people do to me, I do not do this to other people. This does not mean I do to other people, what I want other people to do to me, different. So this everybody can practice their life. Mm-hmm. Small things, if you're eating, I like spicy food. I don't want to force other people, all spicy food is very good. I like beef, I don't want to force people, all beef is very healthy. I'm vegetarian, I don't want to force other people vegetarian. Mm-hmm. So this Su, emphasis, I think, they like, you can practice. Also, important things, like a war. You know, I don't want other people to destroy my country. I don't want to destroy other people's country. So this Su, I think, talk of philosophy, talk of speech, lesson, same. Most people speak too much. They don't want to listen to other people's speech. They just speak. So I think Su, you can practice. If you will practice Su, I would say, all religion. We can together.